I do think that there are some, you know, kind of fever currents through Minneapolis politics. I think in the last 4 years now, we've seen kind of, you know, a lot of what I would describe as factionalism, that there are these like really intense divides between policing is the obvious thing, but there's other issues as well, where, you know, people feel like they have to join a camp, and then once you're in the camp, or if you have a more nuanced view or something, you can't really express it, or, you know, you'll make an enemy somewhere else. I mean, it's just become very difficult to have just a sort of a straightforward conversation on some of these things.
This is a real thing.
None of you have the balls to stop this. Stop this.
I've got plenty of time. I have nothing else going on today.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now.
So I'll tell you how I spent my day is deep research on Will Stancil, because I've been aware of you on Twitter for a long time, but apparently I don't consume enough tweets to understand why you are. And I'm sorry for starting the episode this way, but like, are you such a lightning rod for people on all sides? Because I think
I have like no idea.
A normal, smart guy.
I think it's that I repeat myself a lot, and it's funny because I don't think I hold any views that are particularly radical, honestly, in either direction. But there are certain groups of people that I dislike, and I'm outspoken about it. And also, I hold my ground. And so, you know, it turns out all you really need to do to piss everyone off is, take a normal view and then not change it.
So I'm a lesser.
Also, I'm repetitive. I'd say things a lot.
Maybe that could be it too. So I'm a lesser online celebrity than you are, I think.
Locally, you're probably a bigger celebrity.
Maybe locally?
Yeah. I mean, locally, it's funny because there's Minneapolis Twitter, which is like kind of its own universe. And I'm not really on Minneapolis Twitter. I can't handle it. I'm like, honestly, I don't even follow that many people because it's just too much for me. And so, like, there's always stuff happening on Minneapolis Twitter that I don't even know about. Like, there's drama and I don't know. I think in Minneapolis Twitter, you're kind of the big fish, and I'm just there. I'm this like random guy that everyone's like,
Yourself short. So one thing I experienced going from normal person to highly occasionally recognized person, notable person, a little bit of a local celebrity, is that people get mad at you. And I didn't understand this at first. People get mad at you, not because of what you say, but because you have influence and you're not saying what they think you should be saying. Like, it is the influence that you have that pisses people off. And maybe that just comes with having a platform, and it's fair game to be mad at the person with the platform.
I get some of that where, to be clear, people also get mad at me for the stuff that I say. But people do get mad at you for the stuff you don't say. They say, you know, why aren't you doing this? Or you have people messaging you and say, you know, if only you would say this, it would say this, it would change everything. And I'm like, it wouldn't, though. Like, no one actually cares what I say. I mean, it's weird. I don't know. It's funny because it's really taken off in the last few months, the sort of degree of notoriety. And to the extent that I was in New York visiting my brother, it was after Super Bowl, and I was like, well, it's 1 a.m. The city never sleeps. I'll go out to the bar, right? Because can't do that in Minneapolis, tragically. Right. Turns out the city does sleep after Super Bowl because I was the only person in the bar. But I'm sitting there in the bar talking to the bartender. I'm about to leave, and I say something about TikTok something. And he goes, oh, I'm more of a Twitter guy. And I kind of went like, ooh. And he goes, I know who you are. And I was like, oh, my God. Am I about to get shanked?
So are you ready to start? So
let's get going.
I'm going to do these interviews. This is for listeners, just so you know. I don't know which one of these. I'm going to try to air these all at the same time, and so you have to sit through my intro for all of them because I don't know who's listening to all of them. There are four candidates to replace Frank Hornstein in Minnesota District 61A. After 20 years, Frank Hornstein is retiring. There are four candidates. Will Stancil is one of them. Attorney and research fellow at the Institute on Metropolitan Opportunity at the University of Minnesota, a prolific poster, as we've talked about a little bit here, and a candidate to replace Frank Hornstein. So welcome, Will Stancil.
Nice to be here.
When I think of Frank Hornstein as a person who cares about public transit, he's a public transit champion. He was and still is. Chair of the Transportation Committee, helped pass that historic 3/4-cent metro sales tax for transit last year. Supporter of full-time bus lanes on Hennepin, which is an issue close to my heart. So do you endorse all of that? Are you going to continue Frank Hornstein's transportation public transit legacy?
Right. So I'm going to start this by saying, you know, I am, you know, well, broadly, obviously very concerned with cities. I'm actually more of a housing and schools guy than a transit guy. So my expertise is really in those fields. But yeah, I mean, on transit, Frank's a legend. He's the bill in 2023 that, you know, was incredible. And if I'm elected, I could, my fondest hope is I would just be able to continue on it, continue his legacy and basically do all the stuff that Frank did. Couldn't do any better than that, I feel like.
Okay. So on leadership, I'm going to ask you to go back into your life history. Think of a time when you saw a problem in the community, any problem, and you're like, I need to step up and do something about it. You know, an example of community leadership, something you tried to tackle and solve.
So I've been involved in a lot of civil rights matters here in Minnesota. I've been involved in, I helped pull together, and I've been involved since the beginning in the Cruz Guzman school desegregation lawsuit, which is against the state of Minnesota, to desegregate the schools regionally. I've also been involved in a handful, or really more than a handful at this point, of legal actions, and actually a few administrative actions, both to desegregate schools and to desegregate or otherwise improve affordable housing. And a lot of those involved, for instance, there was an administrative complaint, which ended up being basically against the Department of Education to revamp its desegregation rule, which was, I think, kind of caught the department by surprise, and attempting to use, some of the arcana of the Minnesota rulemaking process to force them to revamp their outdated rule. And so there's been, I would say that I'm a pretty practiced, I don't know if this is, you know, community leadership so much as it is just policy, but pretty practiced at sort of taking these fights directly to the institutions that need to be confronted to improve civil rights in schools, housing, and sort of getting into the weeds on some of this stuff.
So I was reading one of the interviews you did, it may have been Reformer or Racket, and you were talking about how you like policymakers. Mm-hmm. Like it was you're giving an answer about like your relationship to the left and the mm-hmm. activists who maybe don't go down and talk to their lawmakers and like mm-hmm. ask them for concrete things. They're just perpetually disgruntled and not focused on getting things done. And you say you like policymakers, you like legislators. So you've had some time going back and forth with legislators. You've got experience.
Yeah, there. I mean, I think generally speaking, you know, so the way I see it, there's different prongs here. I mean, you have to have an activist, base. I mean, you need people lobbying, making noise for change, and that creates the pressure for change. I think a lot of times it's helpful to have even a litigation strategy if that's available, if you need to make change. I think courts can essentially create a pressure that can't be avoided, that something has to be done. But ultimately with policy, policy is a complicated thing. There's unintended consequences. These systems are very complicated. There are very few systems that are, where there's, a single solution that just solves all the problems. You need to be able to sit in a room with someone, talk in good faith about the nuances of the system, and then come to a solution, and it needs to be a solution that's politically palatable. Because if it's rejected by policymakers, by legislators for political reasons, it really doesn't matter. Litigation activism isn't going to make that much of a difference. And so, policy is how you encode the pressure, how you take the pressure that you've created through these other mechanisms, and you know, write it into law, write it into a form that can't easily be changed, and how you get durable gains. And so, you know, and one thing also I discover, you know, when you talk to policymakers, I mean, obviously, you know, with the exception of people who, you know, for instance, on the very far right, who are just lunatics, but when you talk to policymakers, they care about stuff. You know, they care about the issues. They are constantly surrounded. I mean, I'm even getting this nail this early in the campaign. You're surrounded by people who are telling you all of the complexities of everything in the world all the time. They have to know that stuff. They have to know all the different considerations. And so they're interesting people to talk to that you know a lot of stuff that you know you don't get necessarily from a kind of advocacy perspective. So right. I really enjoy, you know, working with policymakers.
I mean, the best elected officials ran for office because they cared about an issue or a set of issues. And some people run for office because they want to get elected to something. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to ask you, what is the issue? You mentioned education earlier. Is it education? Yeah. Is that like the issue that drives you?
So I have this on my website. I've got too many things on my website that I care about. But there's really five things. I'm going to run through them really fast. Okay. One is revitalizing Minneapolis. I love Minneapolis. I lived here 15 years. You know, I love Uptown. I love the Wedge. I really want to bring, you know, it back to what it was in terms of some of the commercial stuff. I want it to be better than it was, more prosperous, more people, more businesses. Another thing is I'm a huge supporter of public education, of public school teachers. You know, throughout my entire career, I basically spent, you know, 10 years fighting against schemes that would just erode public education, these Rube Goldberg schemes that were, you know, terrible for public schools and, you know, sort of dice them apart. And I really want to get back to a sort of universal system of public education where, you know, every kid can go and be educated fully to be a member of democracy. And part of that is also just supporting teachers who are the core of this, you know, paying them more, making sure they're safe and that they have the environments they can work in. I'm really, interested in decarbonization, just because it's 50 degrees in March and there's no snow. It's terrifying. And I think that, you know, we have these great goals from the DFL, net zero by 2050, but there are still lots of technical hurdles to decarbonizing. I think that we have, you know, we haven't solved all the technical questions here, especially in these sectors like agriculture or, you know, construction. And so I think that, you know, really having a roadmap that both, you know, uses existing technology to the degree possible and also says, here are the pitfalls, here are the things we don't know, is, you know, the only way to do this. And it's going to be necessary for the future. I'm really interested in government accountability stuff. I find it kind of outrageous when, you know, you see instances, there's sort of a tendency to over rely on public-private kind of arrangements and you just farm money into the private sector. It ends up, you know, being wasted or used inefficiently. We can't measure outcomes, and sometimes there's just a big scandal where tons of it gets stolen. I really would prefer a system in which, you know, we have strong government institutions that are trusted to do a lot of these public services, and, you know, getting back to that old sort of almost sewer socialism vision of effective government. And then I guess sort of, you know, over it all, I'm a civil rights guy. You know, I'm on Twitter and I tweet a lot because I hate Trump. I hate the far right. I'm terrified of those politics. And I think I'm worried that in November, I mean, if Trump wins, the last line of defense between Minnesotans and, you know, LGBT people, immigrants, women, people of color, is going to be the state government. And I think that, you know, to the extent that this is going to, we have to fight to protect these people, I want to be on the wall fighting to protect these people. It's really important to me.
So did you read that reformer thing about, I think a mother's love was mentioned. It was about how nonprofits have really cleaned up at the legislature recently.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of, you see that as a problem that a bunch of money is being sent to nonprofits? Maybe it's being used well, maybe not. Are we tracking it? Is that something you want to address?
Yes, I do see this as a problem. Not a blanket problem, because there are organizations that are, you know, well-established, that are well-run. You know, I don't think that we should just freeze every nonprofit, every private organization out of partnership with government. But I do think there's a tendency sometimes, because it's a little easier to, you know, give a grant to a private organization than to prop up a public program. There's a tendency to over-rely on public-private partnerships. I think in some circumstances it can be politically attractive, because you are essentially, you know, it's a way to benefit constituents. But what happens, I think, with this is you can build industries that then lobby for themselves, for instance. I mean, the example throughout my career, what I've run into as I work on housing policy, is that we have a very large affordable housing industry in the Twin Cities. There's a lot of in developers, private developers, nonprofit developers, and although some of them are good and some of them are less good, the industry has developed sort of a set of interests and a set of political positions that it supports its perpetuation, and then they go to the legislature and lobby for more money. And my view is that, for instance, a lot of this housing would be better built by a truly public agency, either in the form of public housing or through like a county development agency, which tends to build more efficiently and in better locations. But it's hard to actually make that change because now you have an interest group that is advocating for the status quo. And so I think I worry about the creation of that kind of interest group.
How viable do you think a more public housing in Minnesota would be? Are there models from this country where governments are taking more of a lead role in creating more public housing?
Yes, actually. Well, so not necessarily public housing. Some of it is subsidized, tax credit housing, which is the majority of subsidized housing these days. But something like the Dakota County Development Agency is actually really effective. It creates many, many units of housing. It does it at a third the cost often of subsidized housing in Minneapolis or St. Paul, built by CDCs and nonprofits. And it's done, and it's done this through a few different approaches. It has economies of scale just because it's a large agency. It's able to cut costs that way. It's able to attract a lot more experts. A lot of the nonprofit stuff relies on many different small groups working together, which is kind of inefficient. It's also better at combining subsidies so that, it can really get the most from everything. And also, one thing is that, it's able to break through some of the siting issues. You have a county run agency. You don't have to, you spend less time, meeting with neighborhood groups and fighting with the neighbors on every single unit. It's got sort of a size and expertise that lets it break through that stuff more easily. So yeah, that's an excellent model. It's been well run for a long time now. And that's always sort of my go-to, honestly.
So as a childless resident of the Wedge, a famously child-free neighborhood, very few families and children, in this neighborhood, relatively speaking. I don't think a lot about education, but mm-hmm. I know it's important. It's an important aspect of having a healthy city. Mm-hmm. You probably want to have a healthy public school system. And so for the uninitiated out there and for the experts who are listening who have children and spend a lot of time talking about this, can you define the problem that you see in public schools and what you can do in the legislature to fix that?
Yeah, so I think there's more than one problem in public education, but first, just sort of a background here. Public education is important even to people who don't have children because it is a key pillar in keeping neighborhoods strong and vital. Generally speaking, it's very difficult to attract people to a neighborhood to sell housing in a neighborhood if the schools are bad. That's the number one thing families look at when they're looking at a place to live. You end up with a neighborhood that either everyone's going to leave, if their schools are bad, everyone's going to leave as soon as they have kids, real estate values are going to decline. It's just a mess. The problem we have in Minneapolis is that we used to have schools that were very strong, nationally recognized. Now we have schools that we have some good schools like Southwest High School, but we have schools that have become really intensely concentrated with poverty. They become intensely racially segregated. And when schools are segregated and have high amounts of poverty, the outcomes just decline precipitously. Kids are much more, the test scores go down, but the test scores aren't the most important thing. Kids are much less likely to go to college. We just completed a study of this. Kids are much less likely to go on to earn higher income as an adult. They're much less likely to achieve well in college. They're less likely to work in diverse workplaces as an adult. They're more likely to encounter the criminal justice system. The far extremes, you'll see schools that have something like a 20% four-year graduation rate, and a much higher number of children will end up, frankly, in the criminal justice system afterwards. So it becomes a problem for not just the parents and not just the neighborhood, but for the whole city. It's destabilizing for the region. And then on top of this, layered on top of this, for decades there have been attempts to solve these problems without desegregating, without addressing concentrations of poverty, the sort of structural issue. And those solutions have often been what I would consider like Rube Goldberg schemes. I mean, they're just like patches, you know, choice for a few families or a little bit of, you know, some special program, after school program, and it just never works. And so we just waste money and time and children's, you know, lives and futures.
And how do we fix it? Do we get to the how do we fix it part?
Well, no. So I mean, there's no, that's part of the problem. There's no single solution here. I mean, this is a really complicated issue. Generally speaking, what you would want to do is restore the diversity, the economic and socioeconomic and racial diversity of the school. So schools are integrated racially and economically. You'd want schools to be well-funded. You need teachers to be well-funded so they can work in these schools. I mean, it's really hard to work in a very, high poverty school, and you lose teachers very quickly. You end up with a much less experienced workforce, and that's a problem. You need schools that are in places that are rapidly changing demographically to be stabilized, because one of the things you'll see is a school, the demographics will quickly begin to transition as you know, you'll see a lot of low-income kids in the school, and then the highest-income parents will say, well, this school's going downhill, and they'll move out of the neighborhood, and then the school gets worse, and it just gets faster and faster. You just end up in a death spiral. So you need to stabilize those schools. In schools that are very high poverty, that are really struggling, and I'm thinking of places like North High School, a lot of times the only solution is something like a magnet program, something that's intentionally designed, very carefully designed from the ground up to be attractive to parents from all socioeconomic backgrounds. That requires things like a lot of research into what parents are looking for. It requires a lot of careful thinking about boundaries, about transportation, stuff like that. There are examples around the country of places this has been done successfully. There's a program in San Antonio for a long time run by a friend of mine who is now, I think, the Commissioner of Education in Maryland, or was, which is how successful it was. He went from running this little program to being Commissioner of Education in a few weeks or a few years. Where they were able to bring lots of people into schools that had previously been treated as just total lost causes. But there's no, there's no like, oh, here's one line and it solves it. You have to think about it really carefully with people who've done this for years.
There's a series of intractable problems in our world where I feel like, well, people must know all the things that you're saying. There are plenty of people who have studied this and know all. These are not, you're not telling me groundbreaking things, I assume. These are all things that I don't think about a ton, but there are lots of people like you who are thinking about this a lot.
Yes.
Like, why don't we do it?
Part of it is a few different things. Part of it is that, it is complicated. So there's a lot of experts, a lot of nerds out there that know about this stuff. But, in actual government, there's not so much expertise. You tell people that school segregation is a problem and they go, is it really though? Who really cares? I don't care about that. And so you need people that understands the problem. Another thing is that it's a delicate political balance. When you are affecting the fabric of neighborhoods, of schools, when you're affecting the schools that people's kids go to, people, get up in arms. And so you have to do it with a certain sensitivity towards, you can't make changes too fast. You have to do them, in ways that aren't too alarming for the people that live there, the people that go to the schools. And sometimes when this happens, it's done clumsily and then it fails. Some of it is also just, we've lost our political will to deal with these problems. I think that in the 60s and 70s, for instance, we had a really strong push towards desegregating schools, to improving some of these things. That's when the Met Council was created, in order to sort of ensure affordable housing exists in all the suburbs, for instance. And then over time, I think people saw a political opportunity in just in abandoning these commitments. And so, they thought that maybe they could solve the problems without taking the political heat, and that turned out to be wrong. So we just have to get that political will back.
Maybe it's because it's your school's problem is also a housing problem and a zoning problem and an economic development problem. And
yes, that's also a huge thing, actually. And this even happens among experts, where you'll be talking to someone who's an expert in housing or schools, and you'll say, what about the housing or schools? And they say, well, I don't work on that. I'm a housing person. I don't talk about schools. Or I'm a schools person. I don't talk about housing. And the reality is you can't disconnect them. They're intrinsically interwoven. But these things are complicated enough alone. And people sort of, you could see the fear in their eyes when you say, okay, now that you're already tackling this immensely complicated housing problem, now have you thought about the school system at all? People go, oh, no.
I'm going to run through a series. These are probably easy for you. I don't know. I don't anticipate you're gonna quibble.
Well, now I'm definitely gonna screw them all up.
Because I don't want to make I enjoy talking to you, Will Stancil, but I don't want to make this episode super long because people got four.
Well, I got call time too. I underestimated how busy I'd be doing this.
So do you support the bill currently being debated at the state legislature that would fix the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act so it can't be used against the Minneapolis 2040 plan and other cities who would like to add more housing in their comprehensive plans?
Yeah, I do think that we need to not have, you know, I mean, comprehensive plans need to be functional.
Okay. Housing and land use. There's a series of bills at the legislature this year on housing and land use items, including a bill to legalize small multifamily housing. Mm-hmm. So like duplexes, fourplexes, depending on the size of the city. And also mm-hmm. a bill to eliminate parking minimums. Mm-hmm. Is that are those the kinds of things you would support?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know every single housing bill, but I'm generally supportive of a lot more housing. I am particularly interested. I will say, and this is something that is, I maybe separates me from some other people on this. That I think that the law of the largest and most important gains for housing are actually suburban. Obviously the city is very important and we want a dense and prosperous city center. The places that, you know, that you see the easiest gains for many, like hundreds of thousands of units of housing are often low density suburbs, that are, you know, affluent suburbs that are not that far. So places like Maple Grove or Eden Prairie, these places have good schools. Right now they are too low density to support, you know, good transit networks, stuff like that. And so I think that there's, you know, there's a lot of low hanging fruit in the suburbs on housing. And I think that this is something that, you know, the Met Council in particular for a long time was their responsibility and they've fallen down on. And so I really think that sort of a regional focus on that is you know, an important thing. I mean, I know we end up in these really intense battles about housing in Minneapolis, and then the absolute number of units we're talking about is like not that high. And what we really need to do is just like, you know, 100,000 units into the suburbs would be, but not like not the exurbs, like the, you know, more developed suburbs is really how you end up with like, you know, really pushing down housing costs, really producing the units at scale we need to house everybody.
You say low hanging fruit, but like the politics on a individual suburb by suburb level, that's just impossible. Like Edina was freaking out when they had a comp plan that, I don't know.
Yeah, well, so we have a great
pretty modest.
Well, so this is where, you know, we can sort of turn to history for as a guide, because the Met Council, you know, so previously the Met Council had comp plan requirements for density. There's a requirement in the Met Council enabling law that every community has to provide its fair share of low and moderate income housing, and this was enforced. I mean, and cities risked losing their state and federal funding if they you know ignored this requirement. And you can go look at the comprehensive plans from that era, and they say things like, you know, we understand it's our obligation to provide our fair share of housing, you know, to meet, you know, as part of a metro system. So there was some grumbling, but they actually ended up doing it in the end. The thing that actually pulled the system apart was not the resistance from the suburbs. It was when the central cities resisted in order to, you know, pull some of the housing subsidies back into the central cities. And so I think that restoring this sort of effective metro system we had, this effective metro comp plan system where, you know, they were centralized through the Met Council and the Met Council assigned goals and, you know, really leaned on the suburbs is the key to this.
Hmm. I've been watching some of the Met Council reform task force mm-hmm. Discussion. Seems like that is probably going nowhere this year. I don't know.
Yeah, that's my read of it as well.
I mean, when you talk about like taking a heavier hand, the Met Council taking a heavier hand, I don't know mm-hmm. who is going to go for that.
Well, one of the things about it is that population wise, you have the central cities, and that's about a third of the region, maybe a fourth. You have these sort of dense inner suburbs that often have high poverty. They have problems that are actually relatively similar to Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then you have these more affluent suburbs. And so if you take the places that have, you know, common interests, which would be, I would say, the central cities and the inner suburbs, you really end up with a voting majority. So on something like a Met Council that was elected, that sort of natural coalition would be able to, you know, sort of make rules for the rest of the region
that's the problem. That's why they hate it so much.
No, it is what they do. Absolutely. I mean, obviously the suburbs, you know, these suburbs are really resistant to the idea. Edina is really resistant to the idea of an elected Met Council because they know it's a tool that we, you know, potentially use to make them pull their fair share of regional obligations. But, you know, as a Minneapolitan, I think that we should do that.
Yeah. So here's another possibly quick one. Traffic enforcement cameras.
Yes.
So, like red light runners, yes. People speeding, you say yes to that.
I'm a biker. I'm a pedestrian. I walk across Franklin Hennepin every day. I can tell you right now, calling the shot, I tell you how I'm going to die one day. Someone's going to make a left turn on Franklin and I'm going to run me over. Yeah. In cities, speeding is deadly.
Revitalizing Minneapolis, what are the state policy levers you can push to reinvigorate areas like uptown and downtown?
Yeah. So and I'm sort of a broken record on this. There's no silver bullet, but I think that, finding ways, particularly downtown, to convert some of the empty, you know, commercial office space to housing. I mean, you're not going to you're not going to eliminate remote work. That's here to stay. So you just have to bring people into the downtown to live there. I know that, you know, people have proposed things like commercial to residential tax credits. I don't know the exact, you know, financial program that would be most helpful there. Is the kind of thing you need to talk to, you know, people who, you know, develop doing this kind of development. But the end goal, I think, is moving people, you know, downtown to live. In other areas, you really need to, you know, sort of case by case. I mean, I think that so there's some street environment issues in uptown that probably need to be resolved. I know I know businesses have complained that the construction in uptown is turned away customers. And, you know, to the extent that that's true, I think that we should support those businesses and try and keep them, make sure that they make it through. I think some of the public safety stuff comes in. I mean, one of the reasons I think that uptown and, Hennepin and Lake has really struggled is that there's a sense, at least among people who might be patrons of businesses there, that it's not a safe place to be. And so you really need to at least convey safety. And some of that's just getting people on the street. I mean, it's just eyes on the street makes it feel safer. That's something that, you know, to the extent that you can make it feel like a safe place to open a business, then you're really helping people revitalize it.
Homelessness. We talk a lot about homeless encampments in Minneapolis. There was a Camp Nanakasi mm-hmm. burned down recently, and now mm-hmm. it's on its fifth iteration in the Phillips neighborhood.
Yeah.
And there are other encampments, and it's been a problem for years. It's another seemingly intractable problem where even in 2024, it feels like no one is taking ownership of it. And it's the city pointing at the county and what's the state's role. And it feels like there's not enough coordinating happening. Is there a role for you to play as a state legislature there? What do you do?
I've actually spoken to a lot of people about this, including people at the county, which is sort of the first stop on homelessness. The actual problem of solving long-term homelessness is obviously incredibly difficult at the moment because it's a product of both housing costs, but also, you know, opioid epidemic. I don't have like a clean answer here. What I can say is that, I think that, you know, and maybe this gets me canceled, but I think that the encampments are an issue. I think that they're a safety issue for the people living in them. I mean, I think that they're obviously a huge issue for the street environment, for the, you know, safety of the city. They certainly don't, you know, even though I think that they're not really necessarily dangerous, they certainly add to a sense of, you know, unease on the city that makes it hard for people to, you know, like, again, open businesses. I don't think public drug use is, you know, it's just not good for anybody. You see a lot of that. And so, I think that we've sort of experimented with different approaches. And I've sort of, you know, over the last few years and just talking to experts, I've come down pretty firmly on the side that we really need to, you know, really strongly make efforts to prevent encampments, particularly in, you know, areas that we're, you know, trying to revitalize. I mean, it's just not a good thing. And it's not safe for anyone. But I, you know, again, in terms of like, you know, policy solutions, I mean, this is just an incredibly difficult thing, and I understand that people are very frustrated with it. And of course, it has to be done with a certain amount of care for the lives and the belongings of the people living in the encampments.
Do you have some public safety talking points to lay on me? How are you going to solve
issues? These aren't really talking points, actually.
I mean, I was moving on to the next thing.
But I mean, honestly, this is something, obviously, as you're going around the neighborhood and talking to people, you hear about public safety a lot. And one of the things that, you know, my understanding is crime is overall down, but we have had in this area a spate of like particularly violent crimes recently. I mean, you know, gun robberies and carjackings. And I've called delegates for the convention and had them basically just start out, I got robbed at gunpoint, you know, like very recently. So I mean, it's a real thing. And so I understand why people are freaked out. I think that it's a combination of a few different things. I mean, as I understand it, there need to be kind of investigative resources, essentially, because it's not a large number of people committing these crimes. It's a small number that are kind of repeat offenders. And so to the extent that you can figure out who they are and then sort of deal with those individuals specifically, you probably reduce them. I also think that some of it is a urban design thing. I mean, certain areas feel like better areas for opportunistic crime because there aren't any eyes on the street. Traffic cameras, honestly, we talked about that, probably help, slower roads onto and off the highway. I mean, one of the things that the hotspots here appear to be places that have quick exits and entrance onto the highway so you can escape. And so I think that there's no one thing, but all of that. And also I would say this is, you know, just lean into it here a little bit. To the extent that, police don't have the resources to deal with this. I understand why people after the last few years, I mean, there's real issues with the policing and certainly the police, the consent decree, DOJ consent decree was horrifying. And, you know, there's cultural issues that need to be taken care of. To the extent that we can get professional, you know, responsive people into the police force. I mean, you know, you do need people to actually be on the ground to be able to deal with some of this. And so I don't, you know, I'm not a ideologue, honestly, on, less or more funding for the police. I think we just need police to do their jobs and get stuff done. And so to the extent the state can support that, you know, I'm not opposed.
So the problem with local candidates in Minneapolis that I think a lot of people have is if you read an interview or you look at the websites, they're all saying essentially the same stuff,
yeah.
Right?
It's like, yeah, we all agree with it. We're all Democrats. We'll vote for the same stuff. This is a
left of center Democrat. And I don't. So the question is, how do you differentiate yourself to people?
Yeah.
Why are you different? Why are you more suited to the job than the other three candidates that are running?
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, I want to say that all the candidates, I've met them all. They all seem like great people. I don't want to say a bad word about them. I mean, they're all great. I do think that I have a few selling points. One is that I have a lot of experience, particularly with state level policymaking, particularly with, you know, things like education finance, with schools and housing and metro governance and municipal governance that are, you know, fundamentally state legislative issues. I would not have run for city council. I don't want to be a city council member. I want to be a state legislator. This is the only office I'd be interested in. Another thing is that I have a somewhat different focus. I mean, we're all going to vote for the same bills at the end of the day, probably all going to vote 90%, 99% with all the other Democratic legislators. But so a lot of it's just issue priority and focus. And so a lot of my focus is on things like these regional issues, the housing and the schools that are sort of broader regional, broader state issues. If you're a big public schools person, if you're a big regional policy person, metro governance person, like I'm probably your person in this race. That's really the two things I would say. It's the focus and it's the experience. But again, this is a Democratic race. They want it to be a really friendly race, and they all, you know, everyone in the race is smart and accomplished. So,
okay. Do you have time to stick with me as I talk about, I mentioned at the top, I did a lot of Will Stancil research. I want to get more.
I can talk, yeah, for a few more minutes, I guess, but okay. Then I got dated so calls.
I read the one headline, Will Stancil, repetitive and annoying, and an influential player in American politics. I think that was the reformer one.
Well, yeah, that was inconveniently released the exact same day that Frank Hornstein retired. And I was like, well, now I'm going to go into it. I'm going to have to announce a political run because I've been thinking about this for like 2 years.
And the first thing people find is
when they Google me is I'm repetitive and annoying.
then there was the Racket article headline. I don't get off on it. Meet Will Stancil, the Minnesota man caught in a perpetual Twitter fight.
I will say that I actually reached out to Jay Bowler who wrote that and said, I hate your headline. Like, I hate it so much. I thought the interview was all right, but the headline was.
So I think this may, again, I don't even remember where this quote came from. I'm sorry to whoever did this interview. But here's a quote from you. We live in a society where there's these like emotions and mad fever currents running through, and we've got to deal with them. We've got to learn the world as it exists. Right. And you've got these theories about narrative and changing the storyline, and you've been in your Twitter career been highly focused on national politics. So I'm wondering if you could bring your focus down to the Minneapolis level and talk about what are our fever emotions and mad fever currents in Minneapolis. What's the narrative in Minneapolis that you think needs to be changed? What are the misimpressions that people have that you, if you could unleash your Twitter power, your posting power to change, what would you change?
Well, so first of all, I'd say that I do think that media narratives play a really disproportionate role in national politics, to the extent that people can believe things that are just completely false about the world because they just bombarded on social media and traditional media. I think at the local level, it's a little different because at the local level, there's a lot more conversation with neighbors. There's less media overall. You're talking to fewer people. So, I wouldn't conduct a local campaign the way I would conduct a national campaign. Like I've been talking, you know, I'm just reaching out to delegates and having conversations. I am not trying to set media narratives of 61A. With that said, I do think that there are some, kind of fever currents through Minneapolis politics. I think in the last 4 years now, we've seen a lot of what I would describe as factionalism, that there are these like really intense divides between policing is the obvious thing, but there's other issues as well, where people feel like they have to join a camp, and then once you're in the camp, or if you have a more nuanced view or something, you can't really express it, or you'll make an enemy somewhere else. I mean, it's just become very difficult to have just a sort of a straightforward conversation on some of these things. And one of the things that I've discovered is that, I've said this a lot as I've talked to delegates at the caucuses, and I think a lot of people feel this way, that they're kind of itching for a little bit more of a conversational politics, where there's a little bit less sort of picking aside, sloganeering. People are starting to understand that these problems are really complicated, that they don't have solutions that are just going to fit on a bumper sticker, and that, we need to sort of be able to talk about the dimensions of them. I do think we have sort of these currents running through Minneapolis politics. I'd sort of like to, take that down a notch, get rid of a few of them.
Everything is culture war. I have noticed, I've been deeply enmeshed in local politics for like a decade now.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, maybe I'm naive here. I mean, this is maybe a product, maybe this is just, inextricably bound up in our local politics now. And if so, I'll probably just lose this race. But I think it's worth a try. I mean, and honestly, I've even talked to people on really, really different sides of really potent issues like the Israel-Palestine. And it turns out that if you just say, if you try to hear people out, at least at this local level and understand their concerns, you can make a lot of headway and people are willing to talk and listen. And that's really nice.
So why did you not snap up there's an attack website against you, and I'm not going to say what it is,
but
you could have easily, and you should have snapped up that domain because it was registered after I had already heard you were running. So what's the deal?
I just look, when I thought about running, the first thing I did is I called people I know in local politics. I talked to, you know, policymakers, elected officials. I called like union leaders. I did not start thinking about what my website's going to be, what my like campaign stuff's going to look like until much later. That's just not how I wanted to approach it. It was more about, you know, who do I want to talk to? And so, yeah, there was this, it was sort of funny because someone grabbed my URL right at the exact wrong moment. And it made me look, you know, it looks a little goofy. But it's just a mental oversight. I mean, I just not, a, you know, you don't think, you know, I mean, it's just as a private person, you don't think I have to register every single thing that could possibly be associated with my name. And so now I've got this absurd situation. We actually know who it is. We actually found the person. It's some neo-Nazi living in Pennsylvania, I think. And so there's, you know, lots of legal action and stuff, but it's just like, just kind of a irritation in this campaign. I have had some older people, you know, maybe less web savvy, reach out and say,
"Oh man,
are you a lunatic? Because I saw your website," and I'm like, "I think you might be looking at the wrong thing."
it's terrible because I Googled you today. I'm like going through your website, all those articles, and the first website does not come up in the search. Maybe it's further down, but like the third result was the bad website, and I don't know where your website was. I knew it was you were a .org, and so I went to that one.
Yeah, that's I think the person may have paid to get this elevated up the search results or something, because it's weirdly prominent. And we filed takedown notices, and actually we've made them take down a lot. They had some really vile stuff on there about some of my opponents, and we forced them to take that down. They got turned off by the web host or whatever, and then they took it down. They put them back up. So it's just been back and forth. It's like the most annoying thing, because I just want to be talking to people, not fighting a Nazi in Pennsylvania. Right.
Do you have any recommendations? I usually ask people for recommendations of things. And do you have a new hobby, an old hobby, something you enjoy? Maybe it's local, a video game, mm-hmm. a movie, a book, a mm-hmm. place that you can recommend to people?
Oh my God, that's such a broad thing.
It could be anything.
Yeah, I know. Give me a second. Let me think. I mean, one of the things, this is not really a recommendation, but something I've taken up that has become an increasingly large part of my life, never thought I could do it, is running. I didn't start running until I was 37, I think, and which is like a year ago. And I decided I was going to run the marathon, and it turns out that, you know, it's kind of nice, you know, after you're done. During it's living hell. But, you know, you feel accomplished and you can do it, and you can go really long ways after a little bit. And so, you know, I really recommend that people try out, you know, maybe your athletic stuff that you haven't thought of.
Well, thank you, Will Stancil, candidate for the Minnesota House in District 61A, which includes the Wedge and points to the north and west, all the way up into near north.
Yeah, it's a very diverse district, as I'm discovering.
This has been the Wedge Live Podcast. I'm your host, John Edwards. Thank you for listening.
This is a real thing. Real thing.
None of you have the balls to stop this.
Going on today?
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now. 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 Right now.